Om, salutation to the Buddha. I bow down in adoration to the Buddhas and their sons and daughters, and to the body of the perfect Dharma, and to all those who are praiseworthy. I will describe briefly, according to the scriptures, the way that the sons and daughters of the Buddha enter the spiritual life. There is nothing really original here, and I have no skill in literary composition. I do not imagine that I can benefit others. I have done this to perfume my mind. While doing this, the surge of my inspiration to cultivate the good increases. If, later on, this work is seen by another person, someone like me, then they too might benefit. This favourable moment, so hard to find, has arrived. Once found, it should be directed to the goal of a human being's life. If this opportunity is not taken now, when will it come again? At night, in darkness thick with clouds, a flash of lightning gives a moment's bright vision. So, sometimes, by the grace of the Buddha, the mind of the world might for a moment turn to acts of good. The brightness is hard to obtain constantly, while the forces of evil are very terrible. What other good could threaten those forces except by that which is called the perfect enlightened mind? This is the benefit discovered by the lords of the sages after meditating for many eons. This deep welling happiness overflows and uplifts immeasurable masses of beings. So this is the opening, six or seven verses of a great celebrated Buddhist work called the Bodhicaryavatara, the entry into the way of enlightenment by a man named Shantideva, the god of peace. An 8th century text emerging out of, if you like, the high noon of Indian Buddhist culture from Nalanda, Mahavihara and university. And it's an enormously influential and much beloved work. It was very influential in India and in Tibet even to this day. Any great Lama worth his throne has to comment on the Bodhicaryavatara, the entry into the way of enlightenment. And I was thinking, you know, in looking at this whole topic of eros and beauty, love and beauty, love and imagination, desire and imagination, desire and beauty, that I wanted to sort of somehow relate it to a traditional Buddhist text in some way or other. Because, of course, this language of, in a sense, love and beauty, eros and beauty, isn't entirely traditional language. It's not as if it isn't there. It's not that you can't find this sort of material in the texts, but you have to kind of go hunting for it to dig it out. And I wanted to do something which kind of linked it up with an older tradition. And that's my reasoning. Perhaps it isn't quite like that. I probably just fancied talking about the Bodhicaryavatara, knowing me. But anyway, that's the rationale. And I want to look at this. You'll notice this term, that the perfect enlightened mind. This is the big theme of Shantideva's text, the bodhicitta. Some of you might have heard this word, bodhicitta. In a way, translating it as the enlightened mind isn't quite right. It's not quite right. Bodhicitta is one of these terms in Buddhist tradition that you really do need to get a feeling for. It does mean, literally, citta means consciousness or mind or heart. Bodhi means enlightenment or awakening. So you think, yes, the enlightened mind. But when you read a text like the Bodhicaryavatara, when you spend time with it, it's quite clear this term bodhicitta seems to have a range of meanings which you can't really, you know, pin down to one thing. Sangharakshita, our teacher, says really the word bodhicitta isn't a good word for bodhicitta. No word is a good word for what we're talking about, what we're getting a feeling for. Probably the best way you can get a feeling for it is both the, how can I say, both the driving force that will carry us towards enlightenment for the benefit of all, that will carry us to the perfection of wisdom and compassion. It is also the full realization of wisdom and compassion. It's both. And for a teacher like Shantideva, the whole raison d'etre of the Dharma life, of the spiritual life, the whole meaning of life is to give rise to and to live from and be transformed by this bodhicitta, this force of wisdom and compassion. That's what he is concerned with. That's the kind of life that he wants to lead. And it's quite clear that this bodhicitta, although it is experienced, as it were, individually, it is experienced as a kind of revelation to him, as a kind of overwhelming, transforming moment. It's quite clear it's not his personal possession or personal attainment or anything like this. If you've, you know, studied Buddhism at all, if you've come along to things, you've probably heard about attaining enlightenment or a particular stage of the path. And of course, this is all very exciting when you read about the stages of the path and stages of meditation, because you can think, this is great, I can attain this, I can realise this, I can move from one place to another in consciousness. But you have to be a little bit careful with that way of thinking. Only too easily, that kind of view of things can be appropriated by our own consumer mentality, which so vitiates our life, that we can get this thing called enlightenment. We can get this thing called irreversibility on the way to enlightenment. We can get this meditation experience, and then it becomes a sort of badge with which, you know, we adorn ourselves, and then we can strut around in feathers and sort of say how important we are. Shantideva blows that way of thinking apart entirely by making it clear that any attainment opens out to others. Any attainment is more like the experience of, as it were, the grace. Let's not dwell too much. There's no theological, this is a poetic term, it's not a theological term. The grace of the Buddhas, the blessing of the teachers, the influence of spiritual friends. It's not yours. You are the servant of this force of wisdom and compassion. You are going to serve it for the benefit of all. So it will emerge brightly into this world, into this life. And it's quite clear from Shantideva that this bodhicitta, the arising of this bodhicitta, is highly desirable. Highly desirable. Something to really long for and live for. Highly desirable. I used this expression to Amita Jyoti just earlier about how the goal of the Dharma life needs to be something that, in a way, one becomes totally obsessed by, mad for, absolutely nuts about, crazy about. You get, you know, some of the Indian Sufi songs that you hear, some of the Qawwalis, there's a particular group called the Sabri Brothers, and the Sabri Brothers often have these songs where they just sing diwana, diwana, diwana. And diwana means absolutely crazy in love with, you know, the goal of the life of the beloved. Well, that is actually what you need if you want to give rise to this bodhicitta. You need to be absolutely nuts for it. Now, I know this might sound rather disturbing to some of you, but anyway, that's actually just the way it is. So Shantideva regards this bodhicitta is highly desirable for all sorts of reasons. First of all, he says it yields the greatest possible happiness. He says, if you really want happiness, and we all want happiness, we really want happiness, and you want to remove your sorrow, you must get this bodhicitta. You must get this bodhicitta. You must get this mind of wisdom and compassion. You must get this mind that sees things as they are and which opens out in love and generosity and service to others. He's saying there's no way you can experience happiness without that. This is a really, really strong point throughout his text. He insists that all suffering comes from just being concerned with your own pleasure, with your own happiness, just for you alone. That will actually just bring you endless suffering, endless dukkha, endless pain. If, on the other hand, you're thinking in terms of doing everything you can from a deep place to wish others well and to actually live a life of generosity and service to others, actually, that will yield, in the end, deep welling happiness, as he calls it here. Deep welling happiness, the happiness that arises as, you know, from a deep well within yourself, an inexhaustible well within yourself. You can sort of see it even in that practice, the Metta Bhavana. This practice is very, very interesting. And I know that the courses are run at the LBC called Who Hates the Metta Bhavana. I don't know if this is a peculiarly sort of London thing, but, people hate the Metta Bhavana, so you have to run courses on it, or whether or not they're just a bit much more sophisticated in London in terms of their sort of teaching techniques rather than us in the sticks, which, you know, you just sort of concentrate on the same old, same old. But the Metta Bhavana is a really interesting practice because, you've got this first stage, which is towards yourself, you know, wishing yourself well, which is really, really important as a practice, really getting a positive sense of self-cherishing. I'm going to talk a bit more about this. And you sometimes hear the phrase, well, until you've really loved yourself, you can't, you know, really love other people. You sometimes hear that. But unfortunately, this gets turned into a sort of dogma. I remember somebody telling me on a study retreat once that you know, because they were struggling in the Metta Bhavana, they thought that the real problem was their attitude towards themselves. So they said that they decided that what they were doing was 50 minutes of self-metta. And they couldn't work out why they were so miserable. And I said, well, I can tell you, because you're just thinking about yourself all the time. You know, if you just concentrate on yourself all that time, you are not going to actually be happy. You're actually, it's self-defeating. I mean, I don't know about you, I might struggle in the first stage. As soon as I think of a friend, I feel happy. I don't just feel love for my friend, I feel happy, because when you love, there is happiness. They go together. You know, that when you love someone, you feel happy, even though you're not actually thinking about your happiness. You sort of positively forgotten yourself, you know, and in that moment of friendliness, of love, you are happy. You know, there is a kind of expansion, you know, in your consciousness that makes you feel good, makes you feel happy. Well, imagine that amplified and developed, you know, to more and more people. So Shantideva is very, very strong on this point, that all, you know, all happiness in the end comes from, you know, wishing others well, really wishing others well and living from that as much as you can. All suffering comes from, you know, just being concentrated on yourself in a narrow way. So I think this is a really profound point. And yes, he says it's this bodhicitta that we really need. There's this line here where he says, where is it? The brightness is hard to obtain constantly, while the forces of evil are very terrible. What other good could threaten those forces except by that which is called the perfect bodhicitta? Well, we know what that means. You know, we know that what that means. We only need to look at our own life and look at the world. You can sort of see initiatives to do good, initiatives, even people doing good, constantly being overwhelmed by very, very negative forces in the world. We can even feel it ourselves, you know, perhaps on the way to work or at work or in some sort of situation, you know, that we're trying as best we can to do good. And yet we encounter cynicism or negativity or something like that. And our goodness just seems to sort of crumble. It just seems to sort of break up, you know, in the face of that. It seems to be so hard to sustain, you know, what is good. And, you know, if you look globally, you know, these news feeds that come pouring through to us, you know, how so often, you know, the good that people do just gets overwhelmed by these very, very negative, powerful forces. What Shantideva is saying, we need to invoke a goodness that cannot be destroyed. And he is identifying this with this bodhicitta, this mind of wisdom and compassion. It cannot be broken. You might be broken, your body might be broken, you might even be defeated, but it can't be broken. So Shantideva is saying, you know, the implication of his text is that all Buddhists, all people who are serious about a Dharma life, need to be living a life to invoke this mind, this consciousness of wisdom and compassion in everything that they do, in all the things that they do, and to never forget it. It's very, very poignant as well, Shantideva's text. It is a very, very beautiful text, even though he doesn't necessarily use the language of beauty. In the verse before that, he says, at night, in darkness, thick with clouds, a flash of lightning gives a moment's bright vision. So sometimes, by the grace of the Buddha, the mind of the world might for a moment turn to acts of good. This is so poignant. This is so incredibly poignant. You know, I don't know, you know, I know some of you here, but obviously I don't know all of you. I don't know what has brought you here, but perhaps it's been something like a kind of lightning flash that has sort of, you know, just, you know, flashed. A lightning bolt has just flashed in the night of your life. And you've started to question and wonder what it is you're actually doing. What is the purpose of this life? What is the purpose of this existence? And maybe in that moment it was incredibly clear. You saw the landscape, you saw the path, you saw the way forward, you saw the bright stars, the bright moon, and you could see the way to go. But then that so easily closes and gets forgotten. And all the business of life, of having to earn a living, having to take responsibility for other people, having to clothe oneself and feed oneself and others, means that one forgets that bright, beautiful vision, that moment in which the bodhicitta seems to open up, this mind of wisdom and compassion seems to open up. Shantideva obviously has a real feeling for these quite ordinary, even quite homely sort of images in another work that he wrote, where it's a sort of compilation of texts. There's a very, very beautiful image that he uses. He talks about our bodhicitta, the bodhicitta, this force of wisdom and compassion. He's saying at first, it's like hearing just the cheep, cheep, cheep of a little sparrow inside an egg trying to sort of break through. He says, that's what it's like. It's just a tiny, tiny cry. It's a tiny, pure cry, a void, an empty, a shunyata cry, a cry of sort of selflessness, which is just trying to break out of this membrane, this shell of ignorance. Well, it's like that. Well, we've got to heed that kind of cry, that little tiny cry that when it sounds within us, a very, very, you know, very, very sort of faint kind of glimmerings awareness and not let it get kind of covered over by the sort of onslaught of existence, the onslaught of life. So yes, the bodhicitta, this mind of wisdom and compassion, which Shantideva, as I say, regards as highly desirable, highly intoxicating. Later on, what he does is praise it, is worship it. Shantideva comes out of a tradition where this mind of wisdom and compassion isn't in any way an abstraction. It's not just a concept. It's not just an idea to philosophize about. It's something to experience vividly and directly. And it's experienced vividly and directly through an image, through a significant image. It's as if you like, and I'm using the language metaphorically, the enlightened mind, this mind of wisdom and compassion, crystallizes into significant form, into significant imagery. Certainly that seems to be what happens to 8th century Indian Buddhists. They don't just think about this bodhicitta, they experience it as a living being, if you like, a kind of person, an enlightened person. And Shantideva's own story, his own mythology, is very, very interesting in this respect. So he was a monk, a bhikshu, a fully ordained monk at Nalanda University, this place of great learning and scholarship in northern India. Its remains are still there. It was completely sacked by the Mughal, the Muslim invasions in the, I think, the 12th century. It sort of it finished. I think the library at Nalanda, I think they said it burnt for years and years and years. So many Buddhist texts were lost. Place of great learning. So Shantideva was there with thousands of other monks, and he was actually ridiculed during his time there. So I'm telling you a story about his particular relationship with the bodhicitta as personified. I'll get to it, but I need a backstory to get to it. So Shantideva was a monk staying in this place, but he was ridiculed. He was known not as Shantideva, but as Busuku. Busuku, which apparently is an abbreviation for eats, sleeps, defecates. Because apparently that's all he did in the daytime. He spent, as far as the other monks were concerned, he just used to eat, sleep, and go to the toilet. He didn't appear to do any studies. He didn't appear to do any reading. He didn't appear to do any meditation. He just seemed to be one of these very lazy monks, spending his days sleeping, eating, and going to the toilet. So he was generally regarded as a rather weak and rather stupid character that the other monks tolerated. So there he was, living his life in this way, the butt of the jokes of the of these, you know, Buddhist scholars and all the rest of it. And they decided the time had come to actually out him as a thoroughly lazy monk and even have him expelled from the monastery. And the tradition at Nalanda was that if you were every, I think, full moon or new moon or something like that, there was a formal Dharma teaching where one of the monks was invited to speak and deliver a discourse on a traditional Buddhist text or come up with a new teaching to the assembled community. And also what was invited was the local king and all of the donors of the monastery. So it's a big formal arrangement with a big Dharma teaching throne. So Shantideva was told, it's your turn. You are going to speak. And the monks thought this was going to be a real laugh, having eats, sleeps and goes to the toilet giving a Dharma talk. What's he going to come up with? And they said, are you going to give a commentary on a traditional Buddhist text or are you going to say something new? He said, I think I'm actually going to teach something new, something fresh. And they thought this was hilarious. And he sat down and he started speaking with those verses that I've just read. Om, salutation to the Buddha. In adoration, I bow down to the Buddhas and to their sons, and so on. And out came this great text, the Bodhicaryavatara, verse after beautiful verse, evoking this life of living the Dharma for the benefit of all beings. This great text evoking this mind of wisdom and compassion. Indeed, as the text, as the recitation went on, Shantideva started to lift off. He started to float up. This is what it says in the old texts. Started to float up into space. So he's actually giving his Dharma discourse up in space. And then he vanishes. And the last verse is just the space speaking and communicating. Fades away, he disappears. And it's quite interesting in later tradition. Shantideva was said to have then disappeared from the whole kind of official mainstream Buddhist monastic scene and to have gone to tribal places, to forests where people had no contact with the Dharma, no contact with the Buddha's teaching, just to teach people who really needed the Dharma outside of this, you know, this quite fevered intellectual milieu, to, you know, show the ordinary people, give them the opportunity to practice the Dharma and to be liberated. What the monks didn't know was that Shantideva's practice happened at night. It happened in the depths of night. Nalanda was too busy to do serious study and practice in the day, so he did it at night. So while everybody was sleeping, he would be doing his study and meditation. And he studied with a particular teacher, a particular spiritual friend, not anybody earthly, as it were, but Manjugosha, the beautiful bodhisattva of wisdom, the sweet-voiced, as Manjugosha is called, or the soft-voiced, or the gentle-voiced. It can mean all these things. Or Manjushri, the softly radiant one, or Manjunatha, the gentle protector, who's also known as Kumara Buddha, the eternal youth, the great bodhisattva, the great patron of wisdom and learning and the arts and sciences, the great bodhisattva who presides over eloquence, who gives ready speech, who gives a clear understanding and insight into things, who is very, very gentle and tender, and yet who has that sword that cuts through the darkness of delusion and holds the book of, well, the not just any ordinary book, but the archetypal book of wisdom, the wisdom that comes from the ocean depths of the Dharma, the perfection of wisdom. It's such a wonderful kind of image you have of this. Of this very, very humble, he was a very humble man, Shantideva, at night, in this strange kind of light in his cell, the night being lit by this beautiful figure communicating, communing with him, teaching him, showing him, filling him, perfuming him with wisdom and understanding, with bodhicitta. And it's so important, I think, that we have and we get familiar with this Buddhist iconography, this Buddhist imagery. You're all familiar probably with the Buddha image, but there's this whole range of imagery in Buddhist tradition, iconography, which is trying to communicate, trying to point to this bodhicitta, this mind of wisdom and compassion, trying to give us a feel of it beyond words like wisdom and compassion. And Manjugosha is, yes, he's Kumara Buddha, the eternally youthful. The eternally youthful. It seems kind of counterintuitive with our own traditions of wisdom. We probably associate wisdom with an old man or something like that, an old wizard or something like this. But in the ancient Indian tradition, wisdom is ever fresh, ever new. Ever bright, it can't be sort of tarnished by any kind of aging, it's always lighting up with fresh insights. It's interesting as well that in Indian aesthetics, beauty is always is said to be new, not in the sense of being original or novel, but in the sense of being fresh and alive and bright, creative, if you like, genuinely creative, genuinely responsive. Beauty has that kind of quality. It genuinely renews you, invigorates you. So yes, Shantideva has this encounter with Manjugosha, and this is, in a sense, what he's speaking from when he delivers the Bodhicharya Avatara, when he delivers this particular teaching. As it goes on, he just keeps praising this bodhicitta. He just keeps trying to evoke it. He talks about the fact that the bodhicitta, unlike ordinary goodness, which loses its fruit, it just fades, like as soon as it fruits, it just fades like a banana tree, a wonderful, very ubiquitous Indian image. When after a banana tree has fruited, it just rots down. Shantideva says, no, this bodhicitta, this mind of wisdom and compassion, once you've got it, it constantly begets itself. It constantly renews itself. It's not dependent on any external conditions. We know very well that our love, let's just take that example, our love and our response to beauty and response to meaning is so often dependent upon conditions. You know, when we love somebody, if they're reciprocating that love, you know, while that's happening, we give love back. But if we think that it's taken away or they do something that we don't like, suddenly we don't love them anymore. It's totally dependent on the external condition. Shantideva is saying, this bodhicitta, it's not like that. It begets itself. It's constantly renewing itself. It's a loving kindness that, as soon as it's in play, will only increase, will only develop. Well, that is, we'll just ponder that. I mean, that is weird, isn't it? I mean, I find that extraordinary, the idea that if you have love, you know, for somebody or for a group of people, that that will constantly renew itself. That tree, which is the tree of enlightenment, begets and does not decay. It bears fruit perpetually. That's the line that Shantideva has. It's always fruiting, always creative in relation to others. He speaks of it as being like a great fire as well, this bodhicitta, a great blaze, a great conflagration. In fact, again, drawing on Indian mythology, the conflagration that actually destroys the world at the end of the eon. Buddhist cosmology is vast. But apparently, after eons and eons and eons, there's going to be this massive conflagration where everything is burnt up, everything is consumed before being renewed again. Shantideva is saying, this bodhicitta, this mind of wisdom and compassion, when it arises in you, is like that. It's like that conflagration in the sense that it destroys all the roots of unskillful action. He uses the word evil, very strong language. All the roots of unskillful action in you. They're completely consumed. I mean, that's why it can feel a little bit uncomfortable, shall we say, when you start getting into the Dharma. You've got all this attractive stuff, you know, this creative mind constantly begetting, this mind of love and compassion. But then as you go on, you think, hang on a minute, actually, it's making me aware of all this other stuff in me which isn't like that. You know, all those kind of meannesses and selfishnesses and, you know, bad-tempered bits that, that's me as well. It starts to do that. You start to kind of burn a bit and sweat a bit. Sorry, I don't want to sound too threatening, particularly if you're new to things, but I think it's worth giving you a little health warning as you get into meditation sometimes. I used to feel this when I used to do beginner's classes. It used to feel slightly uncomfortable because you know, you're doing, you're teaching all this sort of relaxation and metta and all the rest of it. But of course, what you're really doing is actually asking people to light a stick of dynamite under them, and they don't quite know it. Is it okay to say this, Gnanavajra? Frighten people away. Because you become aware of all this stuff. But it's great because it's liberating. It's completely liberating, even though you might go through a sort of painful sort of period. And Gnanavajra wisely said that Shantideva is a solar symbol. He's like, in verses, when you praise him, he's likened to a great sun. A great sun, you know, that just lights up all the delusion. It's just, and that wisdom is like, is likened to the sun that makes it daytime. You know, after all the night of ignorance, this arising of the mind of wisdom and compassion is like the sun that makes it daytime. A beautiful summer's morning where everything is clear, everything is bright. And just to, you know, balance it out, Shantideva also says that this bodhicitta, it's just like the moon. Manjugosha sits on a moon mat. That white bit that he's sitting on is a moon mat. That the bodhicitta is cool as well, like a beautiful full moon, just cooling all the sort of heat, you know, of our suffering and all of the negativity that causes it and causes it in others. So you can see from just the little things I'm saying here that for somebody like Shantideva, Manjugosha and this bodhicitta who Manjugosha embodies is absolutely everything. It's absolutely everything and highly desirable, you know, to invoke. There's another very beautiful verse and a verse I'm particularly fond of. He also likens it to this bodhicitta too, well, uses Indian alchemical imagery. He says, taking this base image of the human form, the bodhicitta transmutes it into the priceless image of the Buddha jewel. Grasp tightly this highly potent quicksilver elixir known as the bodhicitta, which must be thoroughly worked. You know, this is really fantastic. This is really fantastic. Once you've got a sort of a sense of this mind of wisdom and compassion, this force of wisdom and compassion, a feel for it, whether it's mediated like an image, in an image like Manjugosha or in some other way, you've then got something that can actually transmute you and transform you. Yeah, we've got this human form with all of its challenges, difficulties, conditioning, which, you know, can keep us very limited, this base image, as he calls it. But once you have this bodhicitta, it's as if you've got something like the alchemist has that can turn base metal into gold, that can actually do something to this base material and turning into something like a Buddha form. So this is really interesting. For Shantideva, of course, it isn't enough to have Manjugosha as a teacher. Manjugosha embodies him at the end, if you like, of the Dharma life, embodies him in eternity. This is what all these figures are. They embody what we may become, what we may be, if we go through this transformation, this transmutation, and meditating, for example, on a form like Manjugosha and bringing that into your lives, if starts to effect a transformation, you know, within you. You might look still like a human being, but actually something is happening to you, which is transfiguring you and transmuting you. Very, very mysterious process, but you've got to work it into your consciousness. So I want to talk about how we might work that into our consciousness. In a sense, the whole of the Bodhicharya Avatara is about working this bodhicitta into our consciousness, into our life. to effect this transformation, so that we become Buddha-like, so that we become Bodhisattva-like. I can't go into all the different details of it, but I want to focus on something which is particularly unique to Shantideva's teaching. It's probably mentioned in other places, but it's a very particular kind of teaching. And interestingly enough, it's mentioned in the section on meditation, Dhyana Paramita, the perfection of meditation, where Shantideva talks about going away into retreat, concentrating on your mind, leaving behind all the different distractions. And then he says this: by developing the virtues of solitude in such forms as these, distracted thoughts being calmed, one should now develop the bodhicitta. At first, one should meditate intently on the sameness of oneself and others, reflecting like this: all equally experience suffering and happiness, so I should look after others as I look after myself. Just as the body, which is made up of many parts, like the hands and other limbs, must be cared for as a single entity, so too should this entire world, though it is divided, is actually undivided in its nature to suffer and be happy. Even though my suffering does not cause distress in the bodies of others, I should nevertheless find their suffering intolerable because of the strong affection I have for myself. In the same way that, though I cannot experience another's suffering in myself, his suffering is hard for him to bear because of his strong affection for himself. I should destroy the suffering of others because it is suffering like my own suffering. I should help others too because they are beings just like myself. When happiness is loved by me and others equally, what is so special about me that I strive only for my own happiness? When fear and suffering are disliked by me and others equally, what is so special about me that I protect myself and not others? So this is, this is just fantastic, isn't it? This, I think, is one of the most profound reflections that you could possibly have. It's a very simple reflection. In a way, it might sound, you know, very familiar. Do unto others as you do unto yourself. But we, you know, very often the simple and familiar things are actually the most profound things. That we know is what Shantideva is getting at. We know actually how important we are to ourselves. I know people have problems with their sort of self-image, their self-view, not liking themselves, giving themselves a hard time, but whatever we do, we are actually very important to ourselves, even with all those narratives. We do really cherish ourselves, actually. We are really important. We actually want to be happy, and we want to avoid suffering. We actually want to be well. We don't want to be sick. We want to feel protected and safe. We don't want to feel frightened. We want to be loved. We don't want to be not loved. All these things we do want. You know, we really do want. And, you know, when you're doing that Metta-bhavana practice, you can practice it just like this. Notice how important you are to yourself. That's okay. Don't beat yourself up about that. You know, sometimes when people get into Buddhism and they discover that they actually do feel rather important to themselves and their self-cherish. Oh, I know I ought to feel that. That's egotism. Yeah, that's a good thing. Haven't I got to get rid of it? No, don't try to get rid of it. It's really important as a human being to identify that very, very positive self-cherishing. In fact, it's important to educate that self-cherishing. You know, earlier on when Shanti Davis talking about this precious moment, the way that's commented upon is this precious human form that we have. It's extremely precious, this human form. This human form, your human form, your unique particular human form is extremely precious and important. Without it, it's actually not possible to attain enlightenment. You know, I know that sounds obvious, but it's so incredibly important and precious. And it's actually regarded in Buddhist tradition as extremely sort of sinful, you know, not to sort of regard our own unique, precious human form as a major achievement. You know, to actually have got to this point of being a human being with this wonderful quality of consciousness that can reflect, that can actually, isn't just locked into sense experience, but can actually reflect on experience and actually can compare some experience with others and can actually say, this is worthwhile, this isn't worthwhile. That is a major achievement. It needs to be developed. It needs to be expanded. It needs to be cultivated. You know, without that particular quality, you couldn't possibly imagine enlightenment. You couldn't possibly imagine the bodhicitta. You couldn't possibly imagine the possibility of the mind of wisdom and compassion. That just wouldn't be possible. You couldn't have the encounter, you know, with the beauty of that mind. So this is so important. Don't squander it. Don't waste it. Develop it. And in the context of this particular meditation, you develop it by expanding it, by identifying, imaginatively identifying with others, reflecting, yes, I'm extremely important to myself. I want to avoid suffering and I want to be happy. Every single person, actually every living being, is exactly the same. There is no difference. I am not special. I'm not a special person. Actually, I'm not a special being in that respect. We are all members, you know, of this universe. It's this incredible sort of image as if the universe is one body and all of the beings in it are the different limbs of that body. That's the kind of vision that Shantideva has for this. It's quite almost a bizarre image in some ways. But you can see what he's trying to do. He's trying to introduce a contemplation, an imagination, whereby you somehow can meet with, imaginatively, and connect with all others, that there isn't really this separation. In Sangharakshita's own commentary on this in one place, he talks about this as an experience of solidarity with all life. Solidarity with all life. And the worst sort of evil that you could do is to break that solidarity. The basic first Buddhist precept of killing or harming living beings is to break solidarity with the rest of life. That doesn't just negate others, it negates you. Because actually life is basically this, there's this fundamental solidarity, continuity, if you like, between ourselves and all life. And it has to be an imaginative act. He's using, you know, he comes from a tradition, Shantideva, of sort of fine argument. And all this is in very fine, complicated, dense classical Sanskrit. So it's a kind of argument. But you've got to sort of feel it and imagine it. You know, we've got echoes in it in our own romantic English romantic poets. You get Keats, John Keats, having this way of talking about the imagination, called negative capability. By negative, he means negative in the sense of, as it were, suspending your sort of ego assertion, suspending that. And by capability, he means identifying with the life around you, all life around you. He says, it's out of this that you create. It's out of this that great poetry comes, that you've gone out of yourself into another. He sort of talks about it as disinterestedness in a very, very positive sense. Disinterested in the sense of you not asserting your own self-interest, but identifying with the life around you. In one of his famous letters, he said that he could feel that he was that sparrow pecking around in the gravel outside his window. He was that sparrow pecking around. He was feeling that imaginative identification with that living being. So Shantideva is saying this is the way in which you develop this bodhicitta, by again and again and again in your metta-bhavana practice, identifying with others around you vividly and living a life from that, living a life of service to others. He takes it even further. He's not content with that. When you study this Bodhicharavatara text, it's not for faint hearts. We used to study it, well, we still study it on our ordination courses at Guhyaloka, and after people are ordained, and sometimes people have massive reactions to the text because, you know, Shantideva's, you know, he's not afraid of really delivering, you know, hard, you know, truths and hard dharma. He pushes this even further. He takes this notion of shunyata, you've probably come across this notion of emptiness, this idea that we have no fixed and permanent separate self apart from others. He said, well, if that's the case, we've just out of habit built up an identification with this particular human kit, with this particular, you know, bones, blood, and all the rest of it. But actually, when you search, when you look, you won't really find an identity in any of this, which can be a bit, you know, disturbing when you really look for it. So he says, then, why not? Why not, if that's the case? Why not, he invites us to do it, why not identify fully with others? Why not locate yourself in another? Really feel what it is to be another. He takes it even further. And just, you know, just to make it really, you know, so you can really develop your powers of empathy and compassion, why not identify with somebody who really hates you? He actually chooses in this text particular kind of, obviously, you might even have particular monks in mind at Nalanda, somebody who's a kind of a rival, a peer, who's competing with him for patronage. Somebody who's kind of, you know, because these places were terribly hierarchical. Somebody who's looking up to him and resents him. And a superior who's looking down on him. It's quite an insight into what that life must have been like. So, okay, imagine yourself as them, so that you can really develop a feeling of compassion for them. Looking back at you, criticising you. I'm not suggesting that you practice this. I'm just giving you an insight into his particular way of trying to undo this sense of separateness, this sense of, you know, keeping ourselves here and others there. He's trying to break all that down and to develop a love that is going to identify with everybody. Because it's dead easy to talk about loving everybody. You see it at the end of the metta-bhavana. Everybody, you know, well, not everybody, but sometimes you see people with those smiles on their faces in the last stage of the practice. And they're obviously really getting off on wishing everybody love and, you know, happiness and beauty and, you know, all the sort of thing you read in greeting cards and all that sort of thing, kind of new age stuff. But actually, you just really want to say, yeah, what about the fourth stage? How did that go? You know, how was it for you when you were thinking of that person who really hates you, you know, or you hate? They're the people, they're the very people where you've got to see that love and beauty, where you have to have that imaginative identification. They're the people that you've got to sort of love day in and day out. It's easy with friends. It's easy with an abstraction. It's got to be with the grip. Now, I hate this teaching, personally. I can't bear it. I mean, it sounds great, but it's so difficult to practice, to be honest. So, you know, I haven't mastered that one, in spite of what Gnana Bhatia says about my friendliness. But Shantideva says, yes, what you're trying to do is to develop a love in these practices where you're so identified with others, you are actually selflessly working for others. And he says that this leads to a very particular kind of effect. And again, very, very beautiful language. Through acting like this for the good of others, there is neither intoxication nor dismay. I think what he means by that, if you really develop this love, which is actually coming out of this vision of emptiness and identifying with others and forgetting yourself in that, you're not thinking in terms, you're not going to be intoxicated when you've been successful in benefiting others. You won't feel dismay when others let you down. You know, because you won't be bothered by that. You won't think like that. Through acting like this for the good of others, there is neither intoxication nor dismay. Even after giving oneself as food to others, there arises no expectation of reward. Therefore, in the same way that one desires to protect oneself from affliction, grief and the like, so an attitude of protectiveness and of compassion should be practiced towards the world. Those who have developed their stream of consciousness in this way, who delight in pacifying the suffering of others, plunge down into the deepest hell as geese.